reconnect and sometimes it doesn't do it.
Hi, welcome everyone to the House Committee on Human Services and Housing. Today is February 20th, 2018. I am going to open to a public hearing, possible work session, but we are not going to work any bills today. Just so everyone knows, we're not going to work anything till we're going to carry over Senate Bill 1525, Senate Bill 1526, Senate Bill 1540 for a possible work session on Thursday. Just to make that clear right off the bat. But I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1525 and Senate Bill 1526. These are the two committee bills that came over from the Senate Human Services and Early Childhood Committee. So, open a public hearing on that. And Cassie, could you please read us the summary?
Mm-hmm. Oh, there she is.
Yeah, we're just starting with the summaries on the first two bills.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1525 exempts child caring agencies that provide adoption placement services but do not provide care to children and do not receive public funds from the requirement to provide financial statements that have been reviewed by an independent certified public accountant. The fiscal on this is no impact, the revenue is no impact, and the Senate floor vote was 25-0 with 5 excused. Senate Bill 1526A prohibits the court from considering a parent's disability when determining the termination of parental rights unless the parent's disability-related conduct renders the parent incapable of providing care to a child or ward for an extended period of time. The measure requires the court to consider the mental health condition of parents when determining whether to terminate parental rights if the nature and duration renders the parent incapable of giving proper care for the child or ward for an extended period of time. The bill declares an emergency effective on passage. The fiscal on this measure is minimal. There is no revenue impact, and the Senate floor vote was 25-0 with 5 excused.
Okay, great. So the only two people I have signed up for these two are Senator Gelser and Senator Knope. Is that right? Oh, we have more. But why don't we start out with you two?
Which one do you want first?
Why don't we do 1526, since you're signed up for that, and then we'll let you get on to your other activities.
Do you want to start? All right. Chair Kinney-Geyer, Vice Chair Olson, Vice Chair Sanchez, good morning. For your record, my name is Sarah Gelser. I'm the state senator from Senate District 8, which is Corvallis, Albany, Philomath, and the surrounding areas. Senate Bill 1526 is a pretty simple bill. What I really like about the bill is that, as you know, we've got committee bills in the short sessions, and in the Senate, one of those bills needs to be a bill that's agreed upon by the vice chair and the chair. This particular bill was independently requested by every single member of the committee without talking to each other first.
Wow.
So that was great. And the bill simply takes language out of the statute that points to intellectual and other disabilities as reasons that the court might consider for terminating parental rights. The idea is that there is an inherent bias as it relates to individuals who experience disability. And what we want to ensure is that children are not taken away from families based on some supposed idea of something that may happen at some point in the future when there has been no actual threat related to the conduct of the individual. Now, that does not mean that children of people with disabilities would be less safe than others. I would argue that right now they are, because they are far more likely to be removed from their parents than non-disabled parents, and that is true not just in Oregon but across the United States. We all saw a case this fall from Central Oregon. Senator Knope and I had the opportunity to sit with DHS and look at those records, and the court ultimately kind of followed through and found that this was a case of disability discrimination and these children shouldn't have been removed. The problem in this case was that the first child was removed over three years ago, and the second child was removed at the hospital at birth. So this was incredibly traumatic for the children, for the parents, for the foster parents, for everybody that was engaged. So Senate Bill 1526 simply says we're not going to do that. We do plan, at the request of AAPD, which is the Association of Americans with Persons with Disabilities, to do a work group in the interim to look further downstream. This is the decision at the court process, but what are we doing to look at how we're providing supports to families that might have additional support needs, and how how we might recognize bias. And I would point out that the conversation already has led to some change in practice. I am aware of a particular case where a family with a disability gave birth at the hospital. The hospital called child welfare to say they were concerned about these individuals parenting and taking the baby home. Their support staff happened to be there from a brokerage who immediately called DHS and developmental disabilities and child welfare, started talking with each other, put supports around the family. The baby went home with the family safely. And the idea being for everyone that what we want to do whenever we can is keep kids with their families and provide support services to keep everybody together. I'll turn it over to Senator Knope, who's kind of led the effort.
Thank you, Chair Kenny Geyer and Vice Chair Olson and members of the committee. Thank you for your attention on this bill this morning. I am State Senator Tim Knope from Senate District 27, which includes Bend, Redmond, Tumalo, and Sun River. And a lot of what spurred my interest in this bill was a case and a call I got last spring. And it led to me looking into a case where a family with intellectual disabilities, a couple of parents had lost two of their children, and they were distressed about it. And normally, as you know, when you if you've been here long enough and you get into these child custody cases, there's always another side to the story, and there's always that kind of that shoe that you expect to drop to go, that's why they're doing what they're doing. And we looked and we looked and we waited, and there was never any of that. You know, it was, you know, they gave their kids fried chicken nuggets, and, you know, I mean, really? My four kids would be gone in a heartbeat if that's our new standard. And, you know, and then there was a possibility that the father could have rolled over on one of the children when they were on the floor sleeping. Well, again, I mean, most parents would go, what? You know, so there just was no abuse, no neglect. And it really just came down to, at least it felt like, that there appeared to be a bias, and that these parents with intellectual disabilities who I've met with, and they are, to me, they were just regular folks, regular constituents, and were very articulate, and I didn't see any reason why they would be separated from their kids. And ultimately, the court, I think, has worked this out in the right way. One of their children is back. The other one, I think, is ultimately coming back. But this took way too long. And so this bill, a short two-page bill, so if you're going to read a bill this session, this is the one to pick. this bill essentially just says our Oregon value is not to immediately jump to, hey, we don't think you're going to be able to parent. Our value is how can we help you keep your family together? Because there was no neglect, there was no abuse. Yeah. And in that case, what, you know, just because someone perceives that you have a disability that you may not be able to parent, that shouldn't be a reason for you to be basically worried that you're going to lose your children at any moment. And so I think this is one of the most important bills of the session. I thank Chair Gelser for reacting very quickly, and you know, last fall we had a hearing, you know, informational hearing, and, you know, about the bill, and we got a committee bill that everybody requested on the committee because we had all heard about the situation that was going on. And that's not just these people from Redmond. There's multiple of these, and so that's why it's so important. And then Bob Jundeff and DOJ and others got together and worked really hard to come up with language that we think works. And, of course, we had a unanimous bipartisan bill in the Senate, and would look forward to your thoughts on this particular bill in the House. And so thank you for the hearing and for your consideration for the bill.
And Madam Chair, I was neglectful in thanking DOJ, especially Aaron Knott and Joanne Southey, who really kind of dove in to help get the language right so that we could make a step forward without undoing a lot of established case law, and have a good start.
That's great. Questions?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I'm not so sure how much I would lean on Aaron Knott sometimes. I'm just joking.
Oh, okay.
The, So I have a couple things, and I guess for either one of you, but first one, Senator Gelser, you're describing the incident where the baby was born in a hospital and there was some issues there. It bothers me that, and maybe you have a little bit better handle on this than what I do, why would there not have been some type of support services in place already, recognizing what was coming, that they were not prepared as the delivery of the baby came, instead of all of a sudden, oh, we have a baby born now all of a sudden, and now we have some parents that are struggling with DD or IDD, whatever. But why didn't that kind of just get nurtured along in preparation, or did it?
So Chair Kinnegeyer and Vice Chair Olson, in the case that I just mentioned of services working well, in that case, people were planning. I mean, the support services folks were at the hospital with the individuals. For the folks who were in Bend, what happened was they weren't even receiving DD services. I mean, these people both graduated from high school with regular diplomas. One of them served on a jury. And I want to be careful because we had the opportunity to do the sensitive review of the records, and I don't want to talk about things that we shouldn't. But I believe that there were other issues at play in terms of why someone made a report about this family to start with. And as has been reported in the press and in the court, the initial allegation was that the father was laying on the floor with his baby, and that maybe if he fell asleep, he might roll over on him. At that point, they then assessed his IQ. There were other people that talked about his capacity as a disabled person, and things, you know, unfolded from there. I believe all of that was reported in the press.
So can I follow up with that? Yes. I appreciate you going down that trail. Let's see if I can try to articulate this a little bit. You can see the problem that we're facing. We have mandatory reporting. We have a situation where somebody calls based on the lowest standard we possibly could ever have, reasonable belief that more than likely this is going to happen. So somebody sees that, as you described, oh, he's going to roll over his child and kill him, whatever. So you're responsible to have to call this in. You call the hotline. DHS has to respond to it. You know, hopefully they'd find it's unfounded immediately, you know, through the conversation. I don't know. But you can see the dilemma that's being forced upon us right now as we move forward with what this bill is wanting to try to do, regulate and legislate a character issue, and also direction of recognizing to get off the dime and start recognizing who people really are, to all of a sudden the responsibility of calling it.
So Vice Chair Olson and Chair Kinnegeyer, I'm very glad that you asked that question. When you are required to make a child abuse report, you have to have reasonable cause to believe that abuse occurred. Sleeping with your baby is not listed as a cause. All of my children would be gone from me. I slept with every single one of my babies and nursed them all through the night. They also ate chicken nuggets. I did not read to them every night, and sometimes our dog barked loudly when people came to visit. Nobody ever called child welfare and said somebody should come and investigate me, because they didn't make assumptions about me based on my race, my income level, or my disability status. So that's one of the reasons why it's incredibly important that we make sure that those that are investigating abuse understand the ideas of implicit bias. The idea of threat of harm, which I assume somebody may have called under in that place, you should have a higher standard. If they had gone out for anybody else that did not have a disability, that answer would have, I believe that answer would have been different. This family also experienced some poverty, and I think that also frequently impacts what happens. Now, as it relates to mandatory reporting, we have to have a reasonable belief that abuse has occurred, and we're going to have that conversation in a minute here. I mean, do we really want to go to a place where we call the child welfare hotline every time there's a middle school dance? That is going to make it very difficult for child welfare to do its work and to do its job. But in this particular case, I do not believe that any I believe it is unreasonable to make a telephone call. I believe that there were conflicts of interest potentially about I can't say that part. There's more to this story that can't be discussed. And
okay, so are you talking about another bill, or are you talking specifically about this bill right now that you're talking about? It sounds like you just kind of went a different direction.
Well, you asked the question about what is this conflict between needing to report. The idea of needing to report actually is not in this bill. It's in another bill that we are hearing later today. But in this particular case, bias against people with disabilities led to that initial call being made. And as to the question of reasonable cause to believe, I'm a mandatory reporter. I report whenever I have doubt. I know a lot of people that sleep with their babies or play with them on the floor. I have never, ever, ever made a telephone call because somebody was snuggling with their baby on the floor. I think that's good parenting.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Senator Knope, we'll let you go back to your committee.
Yep.
You could stay there if you would like, because we only have two other people signed up, Cynthia Stinson and Bob Jundeff. Then you can just roll on into the next
panel right
after that.
Very good.
Unless there's anyone else in the audience that would like to testify on 1526 is what we're hearing up first.
Good morning, Chair Kengeyer, Vice Chairs Olson and Sanchez. For the record, my name is Cynthia Stinson. I'm the Legislative Coordinator for Child Welfare with the Department of Human Services. And I just wanted to say that DHS is fine with the bill in the engrossed version, and want to thank Disability Rights Oregon and Bob Jundep and Department of Justice for negotiating the amendment that we are comfortable with.
Good morning, Chair Kengeyer, Vice Chair Olson, and Sanchez. This is a really good bill, and it just recognizes the fact that parents have all sorts of challenges, that there are behaviors that we must be concerned about if they get too far outside of the area where children can be kept safe. However, a person's disability or their status, various types of statuses, can oftentimes be more prejudicial than they can be informative of a person's ability to parent. So I want to thank everyone who's been involved with this bill. I think it's a very good bill, and it sends the right message that we're going to pay attention to the important things, which is keeping children safe, and not the things that are not relevant to that. So thank you.
Your name for the record, I guess.
I didn't say that. Bob Jundep from Disability Rights Oregon. Thank you.
I forget when I know people to be listening to that. Thank you. Any questions for the panel? Okay, thank you so much. So we also have House Bill 1525 up for a public hearing. So, Senator Gelser.
Thank you, Chair Kengeyer. This one is very easy. Adoption agencies are defined as child caring agencies. Child caring agencies are required. Do I need to, for the record, my name is Sarah Gelser, District 8.
Thank you.
Yeah, same place. Haven't moved since we last spoke. Sorry, I lost my train of thought. We only have decaf coffee at my house this morning, and that is a real problem. So child caring agencies, adoption agencies are defined as child caring agencies, and depending on your size, every year when you're caring for children, you need to submit a CPA reviewed audit to the Department of Human Services or an actual audit. Certain adoption agencies receive no public funds, and they never care for children because they never touch the children. They're kind of facilitating these adoptions. There's absolutely no reason for the state to be meddling in the affairs of their finance because there's no risk to the state. So this takes them out and says they don't have to send that report in anymore.
Chair Kengeyer, Vice Chair Sanchez and Olson. For the record, my name is Cynthia Stinson. I'm a legislative coordinator with Child Welfare for the Department of Human Services. And just wanted to put on the record that we have no concerns with this bill. Thank you.
Any questions on this bill? Okay, seeing none, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1525 and Senate Bill 1526 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1540. Yeah.
Do you want me to go away or stay?
Nope, you. Okay. Senator Gelser, please introduce it to us.
Right. Have you already done the summary on that one?
Nope.
Do the summary.
Thank you. Thank you, Vice Chair Sanchez. I haven't had my coffee either. This is tea with no caffeine.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1540A exempts from the definition of abuse any sexual contact or intercourse between a child over the age of 12 and a person under the age of 21 if the person is not 3 years older than the child and sexual contact is not the result of force, intimidation, or coercion. The measure authorizes the Department of Human Services or a law enforcement agency to conduct abuse investigations on school premises and requires DHS or the law enforcement agency to conducting the investigation to present adequate identification to school staff members. The measure requires school staff members to cooperate with the investigation and, at a minimum, allow DHS or the law enforcement agency conducting the investigation to access to the child and a private space to interview the child. The measure prohibits school administrators and staff from notifying any person of the investigation other than DHS, the law enforcement agency, and school employees necessary to enable the investigation, and clarifies that information obtained during the investigation is not part of the child's school record. The measure also expands the definition of adult to include a person who is receiving mental health treatment in a community program facility or state hospital for treatment of substance abuse or mental illness. The measure includes in the definition of community program providers whose services are paid for directly or indirectly by the Oregon Health Authority. The fiscal on this is indeterminate. The revenue is no impact, and the Senate floor vote was 16 A, 11 nay, and 3 excused.
Chair Kenny Geyer, Vice Chair Sanchez, Vice Chair Olson. For your record, my name is Sarah Gelser, State Senator from Senate District 8. This is truly an omnibus bill, and I'm going to start in Section 2, 3, 4, and then go back to Section 1, which is where there is the most discussion. So starting with Section 2 of the bill, you will likely remember this bill from last session. It was Senate Bill 101, and this had to do with what happens when there is a child abuse investigation that takes place at school, and someone from DHS comes and talks to a child. So we came, your committee did very good work and brought people to a resolution. There remained a school district that was concerned that the language still was not clear enough because it said if an investigation takes place on a school district office, and they would feel more comfortable if it says that DHS has the authority, which is more direct than if. And then there apparently have been some communication issues in some parts of the state, and people would feel better if the law clearly stated that the DHS employee needs to provide identification to demonstrate that they are in fact a DHS employee to access the child. The stakeholders that worked to negotiate last time got together, they brought this language together, and there was no opposition or concern to that. This should allow us to move forward and help people have collaborative relationships to do appropriate investigations. Section 3 of the bill is where this bill actually started. This is what I intentionally, originally intended the bill to do. We needed to do some cleanup around adult abuse investigation because we have changed other parts of the statute, and this part had not kept up. Currently, our statute says that an adult who has mental illness that is covered by the vulnerable adult statute is a person who is receiving services from a community mental health program. When we reorganized our health care programs and started delivering services through CCOs, in many parts of the state, the funding for those community mental health services runs through the CCO. So even though the individual might go to the community mental health program, the community mental health program might make the referrals for the services, it is the CCO that actually pays, or a CCO provider. So we've had instances where there has been a substantiated allegation of abuse. That abuse has been overturned on appeal because the person was theoretically not eligible because the services were paid for by the CCO rather than the community mental health program. So this just clarifies that and updates the language to address who is covered, that we're talking about people with a severe and persistent mental illness. So it's not every person that's ever gone to get treatment for anxiety or depression or grief. These are people that are exceptionally vulnerable. The second thing that this fixes is that when there were some other DHS reorganizations, the statute became unclear as to whether OWAPI has the authority to investigate abuse at the Oregon State Hospital. So without the change in this language, it is unclear if anybody has the authority to follow up on and do the investigations for abuse. So right now, as a consequence of that, and this was put on the record on the Senate side, investigations that have been done by OWAPI during this time of dispute, whether they have authority or not, those substantiated allegations cannot be in a person's background check record because it's unclear whether they have the authority to do that. So this language restores and clarifies the ability for OWAPI to do that. Important to put on the record that that will not change what happens to those dispositions that happen during this disputed period. Those will not go on the background check. When someone goes to work in a Human Services Agency moving forward, once it's clear that OWAPI is the entity that has the ability to do that investigation, that will change. The other thing that this does is that currently the OWAPI does not have the authority to investigate abuse in a residential substance abuse treatment program. And what's really important to understand, the way that this is constructed, a person receiving substance abuse treatment is only considered vulnerable and covered by the statute while they are physically living in this program. So if I go in for residential treatment and I disclose that I'm living in a domestic violence situation, this bill does not require that to be reported. That is private information that belongs to that individual. They decide how to share that information and whether to seek services. What this is about is allowing OWAPI and the Department of Human Services and the Oregon Health Authority to maintain quality and safety as it's provided by these programs that are serving individuals. Justin Hopkins is here, and he's going to talk to you a little bit about some of the challenges that they have encountered. And we saw one of those actually start to play out. A couple of years ago, the department revoked the license or issued an intent to revoke the license of a child caring agency in Burns, Oregon, that was called the Eastern Oregon Academy. They closed, shut down, turned around, applied for a license, and were given a license to provide adult substance abuse treatment, residential, for men. And one of the reasons that they described this would work better in the community, the director told the local paper, they were not as restricted in their ability to do things like put hands on the people as they were for children. These are incredibly vulnerable individuals, and we really need to make sure that we have high-quality substance treatment programs. So that is what that section does. Also wanting to put on the record that we have committed to the community mental health programs, particularly Multnomah County, that we will watch the implementation of the shifting of this definition to see if there's any increased workload over time, so that we can talk about that coming into the next session. A long time ago, different counties do their abuse investigations of both residential treatment and adult abuse investigations in different ways. We have given developmental disability programs money to have investigators. We've never done that on the mental health side, and that's something that we really need to pay attention to. We've got to look at that mechanism, and I hope that's something that we can come back and look at. So that is that section. Section 4 is the emergency clause. The emergency clause is important. That always comes up because we really need to deal with the OWAPI situation and this situation of who is paying for the services and are these vulnerable individuals covered. Now, the fun part. Section 1 of the bill updates the definition of abuse as it relates to sex abuse. In our child abuse reporting statute, which it's actually technically wrong to call it our child abuse reporting statute, this is our statute that defines what abuse is. We point to the criminal statute to say what sex abuse is. Our criminal statute lists out a variety of issues that basically say if you're under the age of 18, it starts with the assumption that under the age of 18 you can't consent to sexual contact or sexual activity. However, there is an affirmative defense in the criminal statute that says if there is 3 years, which is 36 months, between you and the other person, that is an affirmative defense. However, in child abuse reporting and investigation, you never assert a criminal defense because it isn't a criminal trial. And it doesn't say it's not a crime. It just says that you have this defense that you can assert if somebody decides that they are going to prosecute you. Because of this, earlier this year, a school district, the Salem-Keizer School District, raised this question and asked what explicitly in the statute said that you don't have to report all consensual sexual activity and contact between that includes a person under the age of 18. And they couldn't be given that explicit definition. We asked for opinions from DOJ and from legislative counsel, and it could be interpreted in that way, that all sexual contact or sexual activity that involves a person under the age of 18 is required to be reported. So the Salem-Keizer School District decided to make that their policy. So every person in the Salem-Keizer School District, every staff member has been told they have to report everything, including their own children. So if I work for the Salem-Keizer School District today, and I come home, and this is a chapter from my own life, and I find my daughter and her boyfriend snuggling on the couch, and they're kissing, I, as a mandatory reporter, would be required to call law enforcement or the child abuse hotline. To me, that doesn't make sense, and it does not support healthy conversations among kids. Now, it's also important to remember that the language is not just about sexual intercourse. I think people have really spent a lot of time thinking about sexual intercourse. It's also about sexual contact. Sexual contact involves the touching of an intimate part, which could be two tongues. So if you imagine two kids kissing, and it was hard for me to get over this. It's just like when my kids were getting ready to go to middle school and Representative Olson totally freaked me out about drugs in schools and all the things that my kids were going to see, and then I almost never sent them to school because I would have breakfast or lunch with him and he would totally freak me out. But it turns out kids in middle school, they kiss, they hold hands, sometimes they touch each other's intimate parts. These things happen. There is a lot of kissing that happens at middle school dances. Sometimes that kissing involves open mouths. And sometimes that kissing may involve a hand that is placed on placed on a butt or placed on a chest. I think that as adults, we should be having conversations with kids about this. But I don't think that healthy development would say that we're going to report these people and keep a list of them at child welfare and through law enforcement to have these conversations in that type of setting. We also have way too much work at the child welfare hotline already. And if everyone is required to call every time there's a middle school dance, that becomes very overwhelming. The debate about this bill and the reason that it was a split vote on the Senate side is this idea, and you're going to hear more about this today, I believe, about the difference of whether the age should be 14 or 12 to report. I firmly believe that the age should be 12 because I've talked with the organizations that represent medical providers, teachers, and others that connect with kids all across the state. The mandatory reporting statute requires that you report every time, not that you investigate to figure out whether or not it's a problem, but that you report. We would all of us in this room would be required to report if we go to a family Thanksgiving dinner and our middle schooler is there with her boyfriend and we see them kissing. I don't think that that is a good use of the child welfare hotline. I also think that it is very dangerous for particular families across the state because this isn't just about who has to report. We are defining what child abuse is. So if we now add into the statute that we create these exceptions, so for people over the age of 14 with sexual contact, that is not abuse. We are implying that under the age of 14, it is abuse. So DHS would be required to investigate, and the statute would say that that type of sexual contact between consensual sexual contact between people under the age of 14 would be abuse. And then my question is, who's the abuser? Are we going to call one of these 13-year-olds the abuser? If it is a 13-year-old that's kissing her 15-year-old boyfriend or making out with her 15-year-old boyfriend, I'm pretty sure it's going to be the boy that is identified as the offender. I think he is especially likely to be the person that's identified as the offender if he is a child of color. What if it is a family that's living in poverty? What if it's not the children, but they decide it's neglect from the parents who allowed their children to be kissing, and that person is a dental hygienist, or that person is a caregiver? All of a sudden, they lose access to their livelihood because their kids were engaged in a typical activity. Now, some people will say that we need to cast a really broad net because sometimes when 12 and 13-year-olds are involved in sexual contact or sexual activity, it could be related to abuse. Absolutely, that's true. And if anyone anytime thinks that's the case, they should and can and hopefully will call under the statute. All of the protections still apply. You can still call. It's just when are you mandated to call and what are we defining abuse to be in the statute. I think a good analogy to this would be in our physical abuse statute where we talk about causing injury to a child. I have made mandatory abuse reports when I have seen a child with a black eye, when I've had a child described to me being beaten. I spend a lot of time with soccer players and all kinds of kids. Kids have bumps, scratches, bruises, all types of injuries. I don't report those every time. A broad net would be we would report any kid with an injury anytime just in case the assessment that we had made was that it wasn't related to abuse. We should not be doing that around sexual activity. The last piece is that the reason medical providers are concerned is that going back two decades, our Oregon Health Authority policy has been to make these reports for people under the age of 12 and to report a whole variety of behaviors for people that are over the age of 12. But this would be a substantial sea change in practice for every medical provider in the state if we set that number at 14. Some have suggested we should just carve the doctors and medical professionals out and say, okay, medical professionals don't have to report and other people do. The reason that that doesn't work is we are all mandatory reporters 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So that doctor, does that mean that they have to report if it's their own child, but not if it's their patient? What if you are a doctor and you work as a coach for a school district? Which piece applies? There's a reason that we have all mandatory reporters, our 24/7 reporters that report the same things. So colleagues, this to me is a very common sense status quo bill. It keeps things exactly the way they are. To put the age 14 in would change it, put kids at risk of having access to adults that they can talk to about making healthy choices about sexual behavior, especially between parents and kids. It does not say it's okay for 12-year-olds to have sex. I am not promoting that. I am not encouraging that. I think adults should talk to kids, but I don't think that conversation should start with a knock on the door from DHS or child welfare. I don't think that kids' sexuality is the place where government should start intervening in that case. I would ask that you move the bill, if you choose to move the bill unamended. If the 12 and 14 part is a problem and you cannot move it without putting the age 14 in, I have drafted an amendment to just take the entire section out, to leave the language the way that it is. The consequence of that would be in Marion County, we would be reporting everybody that's under the age of 18. But I can't support putting in statute that two 13-year-olds kissing is by definition child abuse. So I would prefer to not have it at all than to do that. And I'm happy to answer any questions.
Okay, any questions for Senator Gelser? It was a very thorough explanation, section by section of the bill.
Yeah, Madam. Yeah. Sure. I appreciate the blow-by-blow of that bill. You've probably had discussions then with the administration from 24J.
Yes.
And I mean, with what both you and Representative Post's intent was with moving forward together as this bill has been written and everything. So my point being, I guess, is that if we were to remove this section as what you're describing right now, that's what you would oppose, I mean, prefer if we can't do anything at all with that age area, do you not see maybe the administration not wanting to respond in like kind on trying to pay attention to what has been done here in the legislature for this discussion?
So, Representative Kenny Geyer, Vice Chair Olson, the Salem-Keizer School District has not shown an interest in being responsive to that. Representative Post and I met with them last fall. We demonstrated the bill. We talked about how nobody in Marion County had ever been prosecuted either for two 16-year-olds having sex or not reporting two 16-year-olds having sex. We talked about how we had this bipartisan bill and asked if they could step back from this policy for the Salem-Keizer School District since it was a change in policy from what they had done in the past. And the response was no, we are implementing this, and they in fact doubled down. So there has not been there hasn't been that type of forward motion, even with this discussion moving on.
So, I mean, if two 16-year-olds have follow-up like, yeah. As you just mentioned, two 16-year-olds having sex. That's sexual misconduct. That's only a Class C misdemeanor. DA is not going to mess with that. I mean, who's going to prosecute that?
Chair Kenny Guyer, Vice Chair Olson, that is a great question, and therefore, why would we clog up our child abuse hotline and our overburdened screeners by taking that call? What is the point of making that phone call?
Yes, Representative Noble.
Thank you, Chair. I'm going to play devil's advocate a little bit. My experience with working with other school districts is going through this process of sometimes teachers and administrators wanting to actually do a little bit of investigation to find out if it's worth reporting. And my philosophy and the law is pretty clear. If there's a reasonable cause to believe it's happened, you need to report. Not report to an administrator, that may be a district policy, but report to DHS or law enforcement. I understand this consensual to 13-year-olds, but what if one 13-year-old is actually using force? And that's not obvious to the person who decides not to report it because there's no investigation. How do we not miss those cases where it's force, maybe intoxication, or some other reason than just age? Because that changes sexual misconduct to an actual crime, to a much more serious crime.
Representative Noble, Chair Kenny Guyer, that's an excellent question. Anytime anybody is concerned, they should report. That already is, as you point out, a crime. This language speaks to that. It talks about a lack of coercion or force. Medical practitioners, if they are aware that any of that is occurring, should do that. I would argue that if kids learn that if they talk to adults about sexual activity or sexual questions, that is going to get reported, they're going to be less likely to have that conversation. So if I have a 13-year-old in my classroom that comes to me and says, Mrs. Gelser, I really like my boyfriend. I'm an eighth grader and he's a ninth grader, and every weekend he asks me to have sex with him, and I really don't want to do it, but he has told me that he'll break up with me if I don't have sex with him. As a teacher, I should report that. That is coercion. But if my kids know that by having that conversation with me, I will know that they have been kissing and have to report it anyway, I'm never going to have the opportunity to have that conversation with my student to say, you don't need to consent to have sex with anybody. That is coercion. This is a dangerous relationship. Those are the conversations that we want kids to be able to have, especially around consent. When we do the training, the mandatory child abuse reporting training, it is an opportunity as well to talk about what does consent look like in a school. Is there a power differential between a football player and a band student, a student with a disability and an AP scholar? All of those things should be considerations. And if anybody has that tweaky concern that a child is being sexually abused, absolutely they should call. But the other question is the child welfare hotline the appropriate place to do that? The child welfare hotline is about investigating abuse in families. I mean, we had this whole issue last session about kids with disabilities in school where DHS couldn't investigate even though they knew the fingernails were being pulled out of the beds of kids' fingers because they don't have the authority to investigate non-family abuse. So why would we call into the child welfare hotline where it may get closed at screening, or if it's a family that is in poverty or a family that's had other calls, all of a sudden that's going to tweak that up because kids are kissing?
Just a quick follow-up.
Yeah.
I guess one of my concerns just on the surface is that what's missing is the inability to get the child, who it may look like on the surface nothing, in front of a trauma trained investigator, trauma informed, to actually figure out what's actually going on. Because my experience is that what's on the surface after an investigation actually often will reveal more as to what's really happened. So I'm just trying to weigh the two. I understand the reporting things that really aren't part of the original intent of our abuse laws. But there are, I'm concerned we may have some people fall through the cracks.
Representative Sanchez?
I'm good.
Vice Chair Sanchez? Okay. Thank you. I think we'll be hearing a lot more about this issue. Thank you, Senator Gelser. Okay. Yes, Representative Post.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Chair Kenny Geyer, Vice Chair Sanchez, and Vice Chair Olson, and members of the committee, and my partner in crime and judiciary, Representative Gorsuch. You don't know the trouble we cause in judiciary.
All for good cause.
All for good cause. Yes. Right. We hide most of it from Chair Olson. How this issue started. You've heard some of the issues, the start. I wanted to go back just a little bit. I actually cut and paste a little bit from the Statesman Journal article that came out that helped get me to where I had to be involved in this. And I just want to quote some parts from it that I think are important. So this came out in late October, early November, I believe it was November 7th, something like that. Salem Kaiser teachers and staff were recently told that when they learn or suspect a student is sexually active, they must report it to law enforcement or state officials. So law enforcement or state officials. Some students, teachers, and parents are upset with the requirement, so much so that more than 4,500 people signed a petition that was given to the school board demanding the practice be stopped. The requirement falls under Oregon's mandatory reporting and child abuse laws. They're meant to protect children, but the district's clarification of the law is being criticized for being applied to sexually active consenting teens. As has been explained, under Oregon law, any person younger than 18 is unable to give consent, so any sexual activity is considered abuse and needs to be reported. But most school districts in Oregon don't require teachers and other staff to report students believed to be having sex. More than 40% of high school students said they have had sex in a survey by the Center for Disease Control in Salem Kaiser. That's more than 11,800 students in that age bracket. All Salem Kaiser School District employees are mandatory reporters. They are required to file a report with the Department of Human Services, a law enforcement agency, or a school resource officer if they have reasonable cause to believe a child is being abused. Now, here are some examples. A 15-year-old student comes to your office and tells you she's having sex with her boyfriend, would like to talk with somebody about birth control. Or the teacher's or the employee's 17-year-old son tells you that his 16-year-old girlfriend is pregnant. And there are other examples. The teacher would have to report that under this policy that the school district has implemented. If it's found the teachers have withheld information, they can be fined, investigated by the State Teacher Standard and Practice Commission, and potentially lose their job. There was a quote that I thought was very good. Deborah Carnegie, I hope I said that well, a program coordinator for child protection services within Oregon's Department of Human Services, said, quote, "You can't have a conversation about safe sex without talking about sex," unquote. So that story came out. My wife, the teacher, Mrs. Post, came home to me.
That's a good time to interrupt you and say, for the record, could you just introduce yourself?
Oh, holy moly, I'm so sorry.
You were on a roll and it was hard to stop you.
Yeah, I'm Representative Post from House District 25, Bill Post. I'm sorry.
That's good.
Gosh, I do that.
And you're the husband of Mrs. Post.
And Mrs. Post, that's right.
There you go.
You did the most important identification
who thankfully
first.
Thankfully is teaching right now and not listening to me. Yeah. Of course, she hardly ever listens to me. But anyway, she came home to me after this story came out, and she said, she went after me, and you've got to do something. And then shortly thereafter, in legislative days, I met with a couple of high school girls from McNary, which is in Kaiser, my hometown, and their principal and the superintendent. And they came to me and they said, you've got to do something, Representative Post. And I said, okay. So the thing is, you guys, there's no newbies here. You know, my nickname is No Names Bill, or No Bills Bill. No Bills Bill. I don't like to do bills. So I was only going to do one bill this year. And then I thought, well, okay, I have that second bill, so I could put something in there. But then I was contacted by Senator Gelser, and she said, I have a bill that I think this would fit in really well. And this is in her wheelhouse, not mine. I mean, this is stuff that's foreign to me. So I said, great, that would be awesome if you could do that for me. So No Bills Bill became Bipartisan Bill. So the Friday before the session started on that Monday, the amendment came out, moving it from 14 to 12. And, of course, I did not like that at all. I have been told 1,000 times why. I heard the testimony. I've been talked to. I've been told. I said in the Senate committee hearing that it hurt my heart. I don't like this 12 idea. And you know what? I can hear the argument until the cows come home. I don't like it. Now, I clearly testified in that Senate committee that I want the bill to move forward because of my kids and my teachers in my district. This is my district. Other school districts are watching this to see what happens. But right now, it's just my district. I hate the fact that we're doing legislation for one district. Seems kind of silly, but it needs to be done. So I have an amendment that is not out from LC yet that would put it back to 14 and would do some clarification on school employees. The point is, after it went to 12, I talked to about 100 parents in the Salem-Keizer School District via phone, Facebook messages, texting, whatever it be. And I said, if your son or daughter were 12 or 13 years old and was sexually active, and the police came and knocked on your door and told you, what would be your reaction? They said, hell yes, I want that. I want the police coming and telling me that my 12-year-old is having sex. So that hit me powerfully. They did want the police to tell them. They want to know if their child is sexually active if they're under 14. They also said, we'd like to know if they're over 14, but we understand where you wanted to go with the original portion of this bill. So what I'm saying is, I'm here to protect my kids in my district. I want them to have a safe place to go, a safe person to talk to about these issues, of which I wish they weren't doing, but the reality is they are. I want them to have a safe place to talk to, a safe person to talk to. My wife happens to be one of those. She is freaking out right now because so many kids come to her to talk to her. I want those teachers to be protected from any kind of prosecution or any losing their job. Come on. So that's why I got involved in this, and that's why I'm feeling pretty strong about it. I really would like you to consider, when it comes, the amendment to take it back to 14. That's where I'd go forward with this and how I would recommend you. And I don't know if I can answer any questions, but I will certainly try. I'm not great at those.
Okay, any questions for Representative Post?
Just one. I want to just double check. So this is just for your district, at the school district right now?
Representative Peluso, yeah, apparently right now.
It would apply to everyone. This is the only district that has gone ahead and interpreted. Yeah.
That's what confused me. Thank you.
Right. Medford and Ashland are now interpreting it this way as well.
They've already decided. Okay, Medford and Ashland as well.
Thank you.
One more thing. I'm sorry.
Yes, I
forgot. I had a second page of notes, and I'm not going to read them all. What I do want to clarify, there was some, after the vote over in the Senate, I received a ton of emails from senators and from people outside, different groups that came to me and said, Post, what are you doing? You've made the age of consent 12. And I said, no, this is not age of consent. We're not talking about age of consent. And I really want to get that on the record and clarify. And that is ORS 163.315 describes that, as well as ORS 163.325. The other is, and I think Senator Gelser explained this, but the idea of the sexual contact was giving a lot of folks heartburn, the kissing behind the school gym, that sort of thing. It is very clear in the ORS 163.305 that sexual contact means any touching of the sexual or intimate parts of a person, or causing such person to touch the sexual or other intimate parts of the actor, or for the purpose of arousing or gratifying the sexual desire of either party. I kissed my first girl in the third grade. Mm-hmm. Her name was Julie. Mm-hmm. Thought I was going to marry her. I had no sex. I didn't know what sex was. I just knew she was pretty and I wanted to kiss her. Mm-hmm. So, you know what I mean? I don't want to go there.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you very much.
We've got
a bunch of people to testify on this one. So we're going to start with Courtney Dresser, Nancy McMorris Adix, Mindy Merritt, and Tyler Scialla-Lakeberg. And we maybe can just pull up a chair so you have four of you there.
Good morning, Chair Kinnegar, Vice Chair Olson, and Vice Chair Sanchez. For the record, Courtney Dresser with the Oregon Medical Association. The OMA members take their role as mandatory reporters seriously with their patients, especially those patients that are most vulnerable. This legislation is about access to social and medical services and not about limiting the reporting authority of requirements when any signs of concerning activity or sexual, physical, and mental abuse are evident. So again, we're not looking at changing what and how mandatory reporters report, and we always encourage them to report anything that is concerning, and they do. Physicians and other healthcare providers rely on guidelines that have been developed by the Oregon Health Authority, which provide discretion to physicians and other healthcare providers to determine whether the sexual contact is truly consensual and within the 3-year age range, or whether other factors, including violence, coercion, or drug use, necessitate a report to DHS or law enforcement. It is imperative that adolescents in the need of contraception services or vital reproductive health education seek care from the healthcare providers, and when known signs of abuse exist, that consensual activity is treated appropriately. The physician-patient relationship is the keystone to providing care. The relationship between a patient and a physician is based on trust, which gives rise to physicians' ethical responsibilities to place patients' well-being above the provider's self-interest. As a reminder, this bill does not limit anyone from being able to report concerning activity. The bill seeks to align reporting requirements with long-standing health care provider guidance and the policies that our providers practice now. Providers have a very unique role. They are mandatory reporters, but they are also health care providers. And they have the ability and responsibility to provide timely and medically appropriate care to their patients and to provide that education that they may need or seek. And they also, if there is any activity, any concerning activity, any signs of abuse, have that responsibility, and they take that responsibility seriously to make a report, and they do. So as the bill is written now, the OMA would ask that you please support that bill.
Chair?
Yes.
Could I ask a question?
Sure.
Thank you. You started off with, this is about access to services. I'm trying to figure out who gets, is it better access, worse access? How does this bill impact somebody's ability to get medical care?
Our concern, Chair Kenny Geyer, Representative Noble, our concern is that if there is a chilling effect, that maybe kids won't go and ask those questions of their provider, if there is a fear that they could be reported to law enforcement or child services, maybe they won't go ask that question about, I'm thinking about doing things that with my boyfriend, and I want to talk to someone about that.
Okay.
I
so
would hope that they would
actually,
go talk to someone.
It doesn't change your ability to provide services. It's anticipating that somebody may choose to seek services.
No. And it might, okay. might stop
I,
them
I
from
understand.
Doing
it.
For OMA?
Yeah.
Okay, one more question, and let's let the panel get through, because yes. I think you're with ONA, so you may have some similar kind of comments that
he actually is a provider.
The provider.
So to go back to the question of age, and you were indicating that the standard is 12. Is there a particular reason why it's 12?
I believe the guidelines were written about 20 years ago, mm-hmm. and I was a young person then.
Right.
So I was not here to say exactly why they were
pushing for 12
that
at that point as a young person?
I wasn't 12, I wish. So I don't know. I think okay. it was just, looking, again, I think we've talked about this, but sexual contact can mean a lot of different things.
Okay.
And that could be about the time we're starting to see things happen with teenagers.
Thank you.
Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to present written testimony in support of Senate Bill 1540 as it is currently written. My name is Nancy McMorris Oddix.
Thank you.
And I am a certified nurse midwife and proud member of the Oregon Nurses Association. ONA represents 15,000 nurses providing patient care in nearly every healthcare setting throughout the state, including acute care, hospitals, public health departments, as well as independent primary, women's health, and behavioral health practices. As providers, I, along with my colleagues, strongly believe that protecting patient confidentiality is an absolute imperative and that mandatory reporting requirements should not intrude on this principle that is central to our professional code of ethics. Senate Bill 1540 is a thoughtful proposal that appropriately balances this need while helping to ensure that minors can be adequately protected from genuine abuse going forward. As a healthcare provider, I need you to know that any teen seeking contraception from me and my practice is asked about their understanding of consent and coercion. That's a difficult conversation that we have. Professional nursing practice standards have long emphasized confidentiality and privacy as it relates to preserving the integrity of the provider-patient relationship in our state. Our provider community rightly recognizes that adolescents are much more apt to seek care for contraceptive services and vital reproductive health education if they are assured of patient privacy in the relationship with their provider. Conversely, concerns that a provider visit may trigger mandatory reporting to state authorities could otherwise deter teens who engage in consensual sexual activity from pursuing preventive care or treatment of more serious issues regarding sexual health. Senate Bill 1540 clarifies and affirms this important dynamic in statute by way of better aligning mandatory reporting requirements with long-standing health care provider practice. Additionally, the Oregon Health Authority's administrative policies provide agency guidance on mandatory reporting. These policies do not require reporting of consensual sexual activity for anyone older than the age of 12. Senate Bill 1540, as currently written, is appropriately reflective of these guidelines that were most recently updated in 2015. ONA appreciates this thoughtful effort to effectively update mandatory reporting standards as it relates to adequately preserving the integrity of the provider-patient relationship moving forward. I urge your support for the current version of Senate Bill 1540.
Thank you.
Chair Kenny Geyer and members of the committee, my name is Mindy Merritt. I'm a proud educator of 26 years and president of the Salem Kaiser Education Association, SKEA. Salem Kaiser is the second largest school district in our state. SKEA represents over 2,300 members to include licensed educators, counselors, school psychologists, nurses, therapists, speech and language pathologists, and others. Collectively, our members serve over 42,000 students pre-kindergarten through grade 12. The Salem Kaiser Education Association supports Senate Bill 1540. This legislation provides the needed clarification regarding mandatory reporting. This fall, our members were extremely concerned when the district revisited the original language as it is defined within Oregon's mandatory reporting guidelines, and we immediately asked for clarification. As an association, we believe the current interpretation of reporting that the district has provided jeopardizes the trust educators have with students and could have a counterproductive impact on the safety of our students. As educators, we do everything in our power to protect our students. Their health and safety is a foundational priority. As professionals, we take our responsibility as mandatory reporters extremely seriously because we know that proper reporting helps keep our students safe. For us to properly fulfill our duties as mandatory reporters, we must have clear and consistent guidance on what should be reported. These guidelines must endeavor to create a balance between student safety while still allowing for an environment where students can feel comfortable confiding sensitive information with a trusted educator. This is an especially delicate matter when educators are also parents and need to have private conversations with their own children. Senate Bill 1540 is necessary to ensure that parents have the ability to counsel their children privately about sexual activity without having to follow up with a mandatory report to Oregon Department of Human Services. School counselors, health teachers, and other educators are trained adults who can answer questions about healthy sexuality, birth control, and abstinence. If students believe that their doctors, counselors, and educators must report any instance of sexual contact, the likely outcome is a reduction in safe places for students who are most at risk and in need of support. I want to be clear. We will continue to ensure our educators err on the side of reporting in all instances if there is any concern whatsoever that there is abuse, coercion, or force. The health and safety of our students has always been and will continue to be our top priority. As the president of SKEA, I would like to personally thank Senator Gelsler for bringing this legislation forward. This legislation provides the needed and vital guidance and exemptions regarding mandatory reporting, and we, Salem Kaiser Education Association, encourage you and urge you to support it. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Kenny Geyer and members of the committee. My name is Tyler Skella-Lakeberg. I'm a proud educator, a high school social studies teacher for the past 20 years, currently serving as the vice president of the Salem Kaiser Education Association. I am also a member of the Oregon Education Association, who represents over 44,000 members throughout the state of Oregon. Our members are educators working in public schools, serving from pre-kindergarten all the way through community college. Our membership includes a variety of roles: classroom teachers, education support professionals, bus drivers, nurses, and a variety of other roles. As a member of OEA, I'm here to share with you that the Oregon Education Association supports the Senate Bill 1540, and we appreciate Senator Gelsler for bringing this forward. The legislation provides needed clarification regarding mandatory reporting. As a high school teacher, I recognize the concern that our members express when the Salem Kaiser School District released their new interpretation of mandatory reporting guidelines this fall. We immediately asked for clarification. We believe the current interpretation of reporting that the district has issued endangers the trusted relationship educators have with their students and could be counterproductive and impact student safety. As educators, we work to ensure the health and safety of our students. As professionals, we take our responsibility as mandatory reporters extremely seriously. We know that proper reporting helps keep our students safe. For us to properly fulfill our duties as mandatory reporters, we must have clear and consistent guidance on what should be reported. These guidelines must endeavor to create a balance between student safety and an environment where students are able to provide sensitive information with our trusted educator. This is extremely sensitive when educators are also parents and need to have private conversations with their own children. Senate Bill 1540 is necessary to ensure that parents who are also mandatory reporters can counsel their children privately about sexual activity. If students believe that their educators and counselors must report any incidents of sexual contact, the likely outcome is a reduction in the safe place for students who are most in risk and in need. We want to be clear. Educators will always err on the side of reporting. If there's any concern whatsoever that there is abuse, coercion, or force, our students' health and safety is our first most priority. This legislation provides the needed and vital guidance and exemptions regarding mandatory reporting, and we urge you to support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. So I just want to clarify, they were very clear that they wanted the bill to stay at 12 because those are the medical guidelines that have been out there for a long time. The question of whether that should also be true for teachers, you said in general you support the, but I didn't hear either of you say specifically, although you support the bill, so I'm concluding that that means you supported at 12, but I just wanted to understand.
Thank you,
that
Representative Kenny Geyer, yeah. And the board. I appreciate that question and need for clarification.
Because this question has arisen since then.
Absolutely.
So, yeah.
I want it to be known that SKEA, we support the bill as it is written, as it currently is listed, Senate Bill 1540, and the importance of maintaining clarity and consistency for all mandatory reporters. It will be very confusing if we start to add 12 years old, 14 years old, 12 years old, 14 years old. Right now, we have clear and consistent. When in doubt, report and make sure it happens. And if everyone is on the same understanding of 12, then it's going to be easier for us to ensure all of our members are empowered and knowledgeable to make that happen.
And on behalf of OEA, we also support that the bill as written for the 12-year-old state remains the same.
Okay.
So can I just follow?
Yeah. Quick questions, and then I just got a notice that we're supposed to end at 9:30, not 9:45, which I had forgotten. So you'll hold the question? Okay, great. We do have several other people up here.
Thank you.
Yes. Quick question.
Yeah. Well, I'm sorry. How many more panelists do we have coming?
We
up?
Have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7.
Goodness. Okay. Well, I just want to put on the record that initially I was, you know, when I saw 12, I had the same, you know, concern that Representative Post had. But listening to the testimony and then listening to yourselves, just words being thrown out there, authority, trust, discretion. And, you know, a proverb that I'm very familiar with and we're all familiar with is discretion is the better part of valor. And because I trust your organizations and I know that we need to remain consistent, I support this bill and thank you for your work.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. So I'm going to call up Brendan Murphy and Allison Kelly. I'm trying to call up people who are either all in the for column or some column together. Both of you have indicated you're for and against. So that is why you're called up together. I don't know if you have any other association together.
That is about as complicated as we are, okay. Madam Chair. Madam Chair, Vice Chair Olson, as well as Vice Chair Sanchez, good morning. My name is Brendan Murphy. I am a Marion County Deputy District Attorney. I co-chair with Ms. Allison Kelly, Marion County's Child Abuse MDT. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association, and I actually served on the Canby School Board for 4 years as well. So I can see this from all perspectives. I'd like to start by thanking Representative Post as well as Senator Gelser to have the conversation around this bill. This bill began with an intent to have a reasonable fix to obviously something that I think we could have been more clear about. I would like to start with Representative Meek made the comment about that trust and that willingness to engage with people who work with kids every day, and I completely agree. We work very closely, obviously, with our teachers in our school districts as well as everyone who has contact with kids, and we don't believe that everyone who's testifying before you today has kids' best interests at heart. But I would also like to point out that if we were good at identifying abuse, we wouldn't have to make people mandatory report. It's mandatory because we miss too many. And it's mandatory because we have people doing their own investigations. And it's mandatory because we need to slow down. We need to let the experts decide when children are at risk of abuse and neglect. I'd like to zoom out just for a moment. And I know, Madam Chair, we are very tight on time, so I'm going to move quickly. Last year, DHS received 76,000 reports of abuse. I need to be clear that just because they receive a report of abuse or law enforcement does, they're not knocking on anyone's door. So as much as I understand that that's a scary situation, the reality is that I think a little hyperbolic, and I think we need to slow down and have some faith in our heroes who work for child welfare that they can sort for themselves what is worth their time to spend investigating abuse and neglect. Furthermore, out of those, only half were actually opened. So right out of the gate, we have people closing down. So I hate to make a state law that would require exceptions when we have mandatory reporters already biting at the bit to not have to make a mandatory report. In Marion County, we have not filed a case, or I believe we have one in the last 15 or 20 years where we filed on someone who failed to make a mandatory report. Let me be clear, it is a violation, it is not a crime. You cannot go to jail for failing to make a report. In furtherance of that, in Washington County, I spoke with my counterpart, they couldn't recall one either. So ODAA came to the table with this conversation looking to make a reasonable clarification around when it is, specifically around that sexual contact and when we can have that conversation. And I think it's gotten so unwieldy at this point. I am growing increasingly concerned about our ability to keep kids safe. As a child safety expert, I think that we need to be extremely careful talking about exceptions around mandatory reporting, because the whole purpose behind it is to encourage people to make a voluntary report. And if we were good at that, we wouldn't have to have Carley's Law, which is an obligation to identify suspicious physical injury in kids and make a report accordingly. So we already have other legislation that goes directly against this idea that we're good at identifying abuse. And even though I know people come to it in good faith, we need to do better. So dropping it to 12 is too young. We are very concerned about that. We know that hypersexualization in children can be an indicator of abuse, and the people who need to do these investigations are the experts, and the way the experts find out is that people make reports. So I would ask that you vote no on the dash 2 amendments, dropping it from 14 to 12. I also think we need to be careful before we presume that Oregon Health Authority's guidelines are accurate. I've reviewed those, and I grow concerned when the guidelines, and I know that there was conversation around that. I believe, Representative Gorsuch, you asked the question about the guidelines. I believe the guidelines just track with criminal law. So it basically says if a kid under the age of 12 is having sexual intercourse, then you must report that. The problem with that is mandatory reporting is supposed to be bigger than that, because we report more than we ultimately investigate, and we, out of the ones we investigate, we only charge a fraction of those. So the net needs to be cast widest at the mandatory reporting stage, not solely those things that are required. Madam Chair, thank you for your patience. There's lots to be said on this. I know I've taken more time. But if I can answer any questions, I'd be happy to do so.
Okay. Let's wait till after the panel. Yeah.
Good morning, Chair Kenny Guyer and Vice Chair Olson and Vice Chair Sanchez and members of the committee. I'm Allison Kelly, and I serve as the Chief Executive Officer of Liberty House, which is the Child Abuse Assessment Center serving Marion and Polk County. I'm also the chair of the statewide network of Oregon Network of Child Abuse Assessment and Intervention Centers, that are 24 centers serving all 36 counties in Oregon. I am a lawyer, and I've had the privilege of working on many complex public policy issues in the state of Oregon for 19, almost 20 years, 10 years in private practice, and 5 years as the director of a Marion County department, and 4.5 years at Liberty House. And as Brendan said, we serve as the co-chairs of the MDT. At Liberty House, we provide clinical assessments, including forensic interviews, for over 600 children a year, and trauma-informed mental health therapy for between 200 to 400 children a year. And that goes to a point that I believe Representative Noble made. There is science around responding to concerns of abuse or neglect. There are ways to engage in a relationship with children so that they can really tell you what is true and real and what's going on. And I think that gets at the point. I'm not going to go through. I did submit a letter yesterday, and I submitted a New York Times article from February 3rd. And the reason I did particularly submit that article is to highlight how difficult it is to pierce through the lies. How difficult it is to pierce through the statements, how difficult it is to really understand what is going on in that child's life, and also how damaging contact can be when it's unwanted, too early, and couched in some sort of justification. That's why I sent you that article, and I can get you a better copy. So my points here, I'm going to sum up clearly. We're not talking about just kissing. We're talking about full-on sexual contact, sexual intercourse, as described in the statute. We are not living in the world of puppy love and soda fountains. We are living in a world of out-of-control sexual addiction, sexting, online bullying, trafficking, youth as young as 10, committing forcible and violent sexual rapes on other youth even older than themselves, high rates of youth suicide. This is a different world. That's why we need to really think through how we think about our response for our process for responding. I can tell you that as a co-chair of the multidisciplinary team in Marion County, I have heard from law enforcement officers throughout our county. They are deeply concerned about the lack of recognition that that sext that you send is permanent, that the videos, the bullying, and the damage that that can do And there's so much common ground around this issue. What do we want for our children in the state of Oregon? We want them to be safe. We want them to be secure. We want them to be healthy and successful. So 2 points. Our support, I checked both boxes because fundamentally I do support and the Oregon Network supports Senate Bill 1540 moving forward. The issue, the network's position on Section 1, little b, big b, 1 and 2, is that age 12 came late and we're not ready for it and we don't have consensus yet. We need more time. They could get behind age 14. Liberty House's perspective is twofold. It's written out in my letter, but also at what point, if you're looking at those exceptions under little I and little Roman numeral 2 about force or coercion, at what point does that become known, right? Let's not turn our teachers into investigators, putting them in that position of having to ask a lot of questions to figure out whether or not they report. So that's my second point. These are just, those would be helpful if we were talking about 14-year-olds, but when you get down to 12, developmentally, physically, and psychologically, they're just littler. My second point is let's just try not to reinforce that shame narrative. The shame narrative of, I consented. I can't tell you how many kiddos we have coming through our center who say, they're little, they're 10, 11, 12, I consented. Well, what does that mean? What did you consent to? It could take years of therapy to rewrite that narrative, to help that child understand, you consented to going to the movies. You didn't consent to everything that came afterwards. You wanted a cell phone because your mom wouldn't let you have one, and he promised to get you that cell phone. And then he promised to buy you some clothes. So you consented. You didn't consent to everything that came afterwards when you wound up on Backpage having to sell yourself. These are different times. It can take years of therapy to unravel those narratives so children can understand, no, that wasn't your fault. That wasn't your consent. Somebody had manipulation. They were influencing you, and we haven't adequately provided that protection in the statute. So I don't want us to reinforce that shame narrative because that's hard to get out from under. We support our school district personnel. I'm grateful for Representative Post and Senator Gelzer for bringing this to the table. I think we have a lot of common ground, and I think that's where I want to see the conversation go. 12 is just really young. Thank you for listening to me.
Okay, thank you. If you guys are okay with holding on, we're going to try to get the other people in. Thank you very much. We have Lori Satinspiel from OSBA, who didn't mark where you are. Let's see if we can... Can we get everyone up here? Cynthia Stinson and Justin Hopkins, who are both neutral. If the three of you can go very quickly, and then we've got two people left at the very end.
Chair Kenny-Geyer, Vice Chair Sanchez, and Olson. For the record, my name is Cynthia Stinson. I'm the Legislative Coordinator for Child Welfare for the Department of Human Services, and I want to speak specifically to Section 2 of the Angros Bill. This is the section that deals with child abuse investigation at schools, and as Senator Gelzer put on the record, we thought we had clarified things with Senate Bill 101 in the 17th session, and turns out it wasn't quite clear enough. So we worked with our partners at the School Board Association, the district attorneys, and law enforcement, and came up with some consensus language and wanted to just make sure that you knew we all approved of that.
Chair and Vice Chair is Lori Satinspiel for the Oregon School Board Association. Here, specifically on Section 2 again, we asked and want to thank Senator Gelzer and Representative Post for allowing us to jump into the bill here with the fixed language that Cynthia has spoken to. We think this clarifies our issue. We can keep kids safe. They can come on our premise to investigate child abuse investigations, and we think we're all ready to go.
Good morning, Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Justin Hopkins. I'm the director of the Office of Adult Abuse Prevention and Investigations, a shared service with DHS and OHA. Purpose of my testimony today is actually to talk about the adult part of the bill rather than the child abuse reporting. Senate Bill 1540 actually addresses a lot of key gaps that currently exist in the statute. There are several vulnerable populations that exist today that aren't covered by Oregon law that qualify for formal abuse investigations. Some examples Senator Gelser already shared, individuals living with a severe and persistent mental illness who are under the Oregon Health Plan are not necessarily covered by the current abuse definitions. Individuals living at the Oregon State Hospital as patients are not covered by today's law. Senate Bill 1540 would expand the definition of the vulnerable population to include those folks. The current definitions of abuse that exist for individuals living with mental illness are inconsistent with the definitions that apply to people with developmental disabilities. For example, there are clear definitions for abandonment, financial exploitation, verbal abuse, and neglect that currently apply or protect people with a developmental disability but do not for an individual living with mental illness. Senate Bill 1540 would correct that. Senate Bill 1540 expands the existing definitions for sexual abuse to include situations where a substance use disorder treatment professional or a mental health treatment professional engages in consensual sexual relationship with their client. Today, licensing and certification boards address that through ethical standards and ethical investigations. However, those acts are not considered abuse under today's law. And lastly, Senate Bill 1540 creates statutory protections from abuse for individuals receiving substance use disorder treatment in residential settings. As Senator Gelser mentioned earlier in her testimony, these folks can be incredibly vulnerable to coercion and abuse when they are legally mandated to treatment in a residential setting. Over the past 3 years, the health authority has received several complaints of abuse occurring at these facilities. However, none of the complaints were able to be investigated by the department as abuse because this population is not currently protected under the law. We've seen pretty egregious incidents where clients' medications are withheld as punishment, physically assaulting clients by hitting and kicking them before allowing them to go outside, staff members sexually assaulting a client, forcing clients to assault each other as part of their group therapy sessions, forcing clients to live in moldy and unsanitary conditions, punitively forcing clients with a physical disability to go up and down stairs, and several reports of financial exploitation. And while these complaints of abuse were examined as licensing violations by the health authority, there was really no meaningful ramification to the individuals who were committing these acts. It was a licensing violation. So right now, these folks are not entered into the background check registry. These acts, even if they're substantiated, don't really have any downstream impact on the ability to for that individual to work with vulnerable populations down the road. Senate Bill 1540 resolves these gaps in the law. There will be some key areas that will be important to address for the successful implementation of the bill. We're going to need to draft rules to really specify the definition for severe and persistent mental illness so that we're really clear about who the law applies to. We're going to need to, as Senator Gelser mentioned earlier, take a look at the workload impact. Right now, we're not sure if these changes in the definitions are going to create an increase or a decrease in the amount of investigations that happen out in the community. So we're going to look at that very carefully over the next 6 months to year and probably report back to this committee then. And then we definitely want to be open as we roll these things out. We're going to need to get input from our key partners around training and specificity for investigations for these new types of populations and settings that we're investigating. So thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, let's hold off on questions so we can get the last two people in. Thank you. Doug Barber and Bob Jundeff. If the committee doesn't mind holding over 5 minutes, I feel a little late.
As long as we need to.
Thank you.
Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee, I'm Doug Barber here today on behalf of the Association of Community Mental Health Programs to talk about Section 3 of the bill, which Justin Hopkins was just referring to. This is the adult investigation portion of the bill. We agree with the goal of the bill to expand these definitions around serious and persistent mental illness and substance abuse disorders. Our concern has to do with the potential workforce impacts. Just to give you an example, last year in Multnomah County, they screened 770 abuse reports. and completed 280 investigations. They think that by expanding the facilities and the types of abuse that are being investigated, that number could increase dramatically. And as Senator Gelser mentioned, the state doesn't pay for those investigations, the counties do. So what we've agreed with Senator Gelser and Justin Hopkins is to track that workforce load, that workload, over the next 6 months or a year to see what the impact of this bill is, and then potentially bring some legislation back in, or a funding request back in the 2019 session to help address that if it turns out to be significant. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee. My name is Bob Junda from Disability Rights Oregon. Disability Rights Oregon is a nonprofit, and we are mandated by federal and state law to investigate complaints of abuse or neglect of people with disabilities. And so we've been very involved in this legislation since its inception in the early 1990s and have followed every development since. Senator Gelser referred to this as an omnibus bill. What I'm asking is that, given the controversy of other sections of the bill, that Section 3 not be thrown under the bus. This is very important for our abuse response system for people with adults, and I hope that it will survive in its present form. We'll move into rulemaking to make sure that details are clarified, and we'll maybe back to you in the future in order to make sure that these services are affordable.
Thank you very much. We are over, but it just came to my attention that there may be two other people that want to testify that didn't sign up. Is that correct? So come on up quickly.
Hi, my name is Marissa Eagle.
And I'm Kimberly Schott. We're from the Salem-Keizer School District. We go to McNary.
You can share the microphone between you.
We go to McNary High School, and we're here representing students, parents, and many staff in the school districts.
Yeah, so when we heard that the law was going to be changed to 12, we were taken back a little bit, because just thinking back to when I was 12, I didn't know anything about anything sexual or anything, and thinking that kids then could consent to it, it didn't quite make sense to me, because it doesn't make sense for a 12-year-old to be able to do that, because they don't know the consequences or what they're getting into quite right.
We were the ones that started the petition that eventually we talked to both Senator Gelser and Post about, and we were all for student safety. We were concerned that students were feeling unsafe and that teachers were feeling unsafe in their job security. Students were not wanting to go to teachers to talk about things, and teachers were telling the students that they didn't want them to talk to them about it because they didn't want to have to report anything. And now on top of this, we're being told that the age is being dropped from 14 to 12. I have a little brother who is 12. That's sixth grade, and he's more concerned about like Roblox and running around playing with his friends than any sexual behavior. If a 12-year-old was being involved in sexual behavior, to me that would be very concerning, because they are like fresh out of elementary school. They don't really know what's happening. In their health classes, they're just now being taught what's going on with their bodies, what makes it seem right that they would be able to consent to like having sex, which could potentially result in them having a child of their own.
Yeah, so we believe that they should put the age back up to 14, because the 12-year-olds do not understand that. We were just 12 not too many years ago, and it doesn't quite, we don't quite understand why that would consent to being 12 years old or 13.
It doesn't seem safe. And it just makes us feel unsafe. And I know it makes my middle school brothers feel unsafe. They were voicing their concerns. I have one in sixth grade and one in eighth grade, and they were both concerned, because also lowering the age of 12 is almost like condoning them to sexual behavior. It's almost telling them, oh, it's all right. And it could be turning a blind eye to problems that they could be having going on, because if they're having intercourse, then where did they learn that from?
Okay. Thank you very much for coming, taking time out of the day. I'm sorry it couldn't happen yesterday when you had probably had the day off. Okay. Thank you, everyone. We're going to, I'm going to close the public hearing on 1540. I want to make sure everyone knows that we are carrying over Senate Bill 1525, 1526, and 1540 to Thursday for a work session. And I adjourn.